me to speak at the... So a subtitle is, what do you do if your reconstruction produces real vector space mechanics? So I'm really starting at a somewhat different place. I'm supposing you've already done a reconstruction. You've got some idea, you've reconstructed quantum mechanics, and what comes out is real vector space quantum mechanics. And so one option you have is just to scratch that and say, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try something different. But suppose you take the other option, which is, all right, let's accept that and see what happens. And see, can we make this consistent with what we experience? Here's real vector space quantum mechanics. You just have this talk will all be in finite vector spaces, finite dimensional vector spaces. So here's a real vector space there, a normalized vector, and the property is an ordinary given by an orthogonal basis, and the probabilities are basis vectors. What's appealing about this theory, to me, is a couple of things. One is, it takes as many real parameters to specify a state as there are independent probabilities of a complete measurement, complete orthogonal measurement. But this picture, there are two independent probabilities, because probabilities have to add up to one. And it takes two numbers to specify a state. What I like even better is this, which is that if you imagine running several identically prepared copies of a pure state through the same measuring apparatus, you get these three outcomes, and you look at the statistics, you can try to estimate where you are. And if you map this little circle here, I've drawn a little circle on the unit sphere. If you map that into probability space, you get a little ellipsoid, or a little ellipse in this case, in probability space. And that ellipse is exactly proportional to the statistical error in your probability in your many trials. That is, you do many trials, there's always going to be some statistical error. Of course, it shrinks as the number of trials increases, but the shape of that little ellipsoid corresponds, when you make this mapping, to a circle here. You get this, and this works wherever you are in probability space, in vector space, rather. A way of saying it is that the statistical distance equals the distance along the sphere. So if you run path along the sphere, imagine and make a little tick every time you get to a state that is statistically distinguishable in some fixed number of trials, then the number of ticks as you move along is equal to the length of the path along the sphere. It's highly non-trivial that that's true. Okay, and for real vector space quantum mechanics, not true for complex quantum mechanics, where you can move along the sphere and make no change whatsoever, for example, if you move in the right direction in the probabilities, because you may just be changing the relative phases, and then the probabilities don't change at all. But in real vector space, quantum mechanics is this nice thing, nice effect. And so I like that. It strikes me as a more natural theory. If I were creating a universe, I'd use this one and not the complex one. Now, there are reasons why you might say, well, nature would have preferred the complex case because, for example, if you have a composite system, then you can, if you do complete tomography on the subsystems, you've also done just exactly what you need for complete tomography of the whole system. That's part of Lucien's framework, and that is very nice. And there are certainly days when I think that's exactly why nature chose the complex vector space. But today's not one of those days. Today I'm thinking, nature should have chosen a real one. Because suppose we don't have the parts determine the whole in that way. And in the real vector space quantum mechanics, it's not true that the parts don't determine the whole. Well, we'd say, okay, we can live with that. Okay, we could, sometimes to do complete tomography, we have to bring the parts together and make a joint measurement. And we could live with that. And there are other reasons. And then there's Phillips' complementarity, which also, some days, I think that's exactly it. That's why nature chose complex vector space. And I completely agree with Phillip that this why it's complex is an important problem. But I'll let today not be one of those days either, and I'll really stick with the real vector space. So what can we do? Well, this was addressed by Stueckelberg in 1960. He also had the intuition, for different reasons, that it would be natural to have a real vector space, and the fact that it's a complex vector space needs to be explained. In this paper, he says, this paper is derived from some lectures he's given to try to explain to students how the imaginary unit enters quantum mechanics. So his intuition is you start with the real space. I'm not actually following this word very closely. He's interested in quantum field theory, actually. But this is a finite dimensional kind of transcription of Stueckelberg's idea. So to describe a system with n orthogonal states, what you do is you start with a 2n dimensional real vector space, so twice as many dimensions as you might think you need. And states are then are symmetric 2n by 2n density matrices. Okay? And the transformation of evolution, time evolution, is an orthogonal matrix with determinant 1. So everything's real. This one rule, okay, so that's just real vector space quantum mechanics with 2n dimensions. Now you add one extra rule, which is that all observables and time evolutions must commute a particular operator, J.
So one rule, that's all you add. Okay, notice that J
squared is negative the identity. Fitting with J basically makes J play the role of the imaginary unit I. And Stueckelberg gives some justification for why it's a natural thing to do that. My goal is not to specify it as to try to take that seriously and take it very physically and see what it says about what our world might be. So that's what this talk is about.
Sorry.
Yes?
You don't mind asking?
No, please. Yeah.
So the chain there,
that's a symbolic thing. It is. We've seen it in Rob Second's talk.
Yeah, so how much of the symplectic geometry are you using? Because you have transformations of some orthogonal matrix, it's not a symplectic matrix.
That is right. The transformations are still orthogonal matrices. It's just that they now have to commute with this. So that's the only thing I'm using. That's all we're using J for.
So I guess there's symplectic orthogonal.
Right. Okay. 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 It may be very important. Maybe very deep. Here's restating Stueckelberg's rule. Instead of talking about J. To describe a system with n orthogonal, start with an n-dimensional real vector space. So exactly as many dimensions as you think you need. But then you assume the existence of just one extra binary object, okay, which is a two-dimensional rebit, that is, it lives in a two-dimensional real vector space. That's its state space. And because it's universal, we'll call it the u-bit. And I'll use the symbol Z to represent it. So Z is that here's a little picture of its possible pure states. Okay, and then the restrictions are these. I'm just recopying Stueckelberg. All observables and transformations must commute with rotations of the universal bit. For example, a transformation can't be conditioned on the state of the U bit. So you can do things like if this bit is up, then I can rotate the u-bit such and such, and if this bit is some other way, then I rotate the U-bit some other way. That's all allowed. What you can't do is the other way around. You can't say, if the U-bit is like this, then rotate this way, my other bit. And if the U-bit is like this, rotate a different way. You can't do conditional things where information flows from the U-bit into the rest of the world. Those are not allowed. And the U-bit itself cannot be measured. OK, so those are the rules. So there's this universal bit, but rules about what you can do. Now, so states that differ by a rotation of the U-bit can't be distinguished from each other because of these rules. And so therefore, it's convenient to represent, and might as well represent a pure state as a rank 2 projection operator divided by 2, obtained by just spinning, just averaging over all rotations of the U-bit. Now, I'll give you a specific example of that right here, or at least another way to think about that. So here's how you convert from ordinary complex quantum mechanics notation to the real representation with a U-bit. So if you have a density matrix or a generator of an orthogonal transformation or an orthogonal transformation itself, in every entry of the matrix, you'll have some complex number, A plus IB, where I and B are real. You just replace that by a little 2x2 thing. Yes, Lee?
Is this the embedding of UN in SO2N?
Is this the embedding of
UN in SO2N?
It must be. It must be. It must be that. Yeah. Yes. Right, exactly. So here's another way of thinking about that same thing. If you have a state, an ordinary pure state of, say, a qubit, so here A and B are real, C and D are real. So here's a typical, a general qubit pure state. We normally say that state is equivalent to this state here, where I've multiplied by I. Okay, so here I've just multiplied by I. Physically, we think that's the same state as this, because it's an overall phase factor. Now, what you do is you take these numbers and sort of stretch them out into a state of 2 rebits. This is the original rebit, and this is the universal bit. And the B, everywhere there was an I, the universal bit gets the value 1. And everywhere you didn't have an I, the universal bit gets the value 0. So you do that for the original state, and you also do it for the state multiplied by I, which gives you this. Just write down the projection operator onto this one, the projection operator onto this one, take the average of those two. That is the 4x4 density matrix that would describe, real density matrix that would describe this qubit as a rebit together with the universal bit. Okay. So the next few slides are just to show what does this look like. Suppose you take this very seriously. What does it look like in the specific example of photon polarization? Okay. So here's ordinary photon polarization. And I've chosen a particular way of representing it, which is fairly standard, which is that the linear polarizations will be represented by real linear combinations of vertical and horizontal polarizations. The elliptical and circular polarizations will be represented by complex combinations of vertical and horizontal. So here are two linear polarizations, which are real combinations. And here are right-hand circular and left-hand circular. And on the block sphere, they look like this. So the real states are all here. All the other states require complex numbers. Okay, so what do some of those things look like when you just follow these rules and write them in terms of a U-bit? So here's ordinary linear polarization. You just have, this would be the direction of the linear polarization. So A is the protophoton. It's a rebit. It's going to be a whole photon if you couple it with the U-bit. It's a protophoton. It's this piece of what you start with. So this is the actual linear polarization that you're trying to represent. If you're representing linear polarization, the U-bit is in a completely mixed state. So it's in a completely mixed state, and that's linear polarization. What does right-hand circular polarization look like? Well, it looks like a mixture of 2 pure states. with equal weights. So it's a mixture of these two things, incoherent mixture of these two states that are equally weighted. This state is an entangled state between the protophoton A and the u-bit z. And here's another entangled state, just obtained from this by rotating the u-bit by 90 degrees. Okay. And you mix those two states together, and that's what it looks like. That's what right-hand circular polarization looks like in this picture. Okay. Notice that this mixed state is maximally entangled. If you've played at all with entanglement, this real vector space business is very surprising. So this mixed state is maximally entangled but not correlated. Let me just say that a little more carefully here. So here's that same state. This represents right circular polarization, mixture of those two pure states. So it's mixed, but it has maximal entanglement in the sense that in any decomposition of the density matrix, every pure state is maximally entangled. So you can write this in different ways as a mixture of pure states, but there's no way you can write it. Any way you write it as a mixture of pure states, every pure state is maximally entangled. This never happens in ordinary quantum mechanics. You can't have a maximally entangled state that's not pure in ordinary quantum mechanics. In real vector space case, you can. Also, there's no correlation. Even though this has maximal entanglement, and you normally think of an entanglement as all about correlation, a particular kind of quantum correlation. But here, there's no correlation between A and Z. And even as I say this, I'm saying that can't be true. But it is true. There's no correlation between A and Z, even though they're maximally entangled. If there were a correlation, then a measurement of A could reveal something about the universal rebit, which is not allowed. You're not allowed to find out anything about, learn anything about the universal rebit. Okay. No one's going to jump on that?
Yeah.
Not yet? Okay. I keep expecting someone to jump on that because I feel like, I can't be right.
Did you have a defense prepared? I mean, okay, I think it's crap.
But that's the way it is.
No, but I mean,
okay. But I raised the question. So now let's talk about...
All right. What do you mean by entanglement?
Yes, good question. Entanglement is if you have a mixed state, how do you say it, whether it's entangled or not? It's entangled if you can write it as a mixture of unentangled pure states.
Okay, so it's because you don't have the sigma y effect.
That's correct. You can't factor things the way you could in a complex case. That's exactly right. So that's a state. What about a transformation? Here's a possible transformation on photon polarization, a quarter wave plate, it's going to turn this linear polarization into right-hand circular polarization. Okay, we'll have to do that. Here, linear polarization is a mixture of this and this, okay, with these two different states of the u-bit. This state, under this transformation, what is the transformation? It's a controlled rotation where A controls Z. Perfectly okay for A to control Z. You just can't have Z controlling A. That's against the rules.
But A
controls Z. So this transformation says if A is up, then Z rotates by 90 degrees. Then Z doesn't rotate. If A is like this, then Z rotates by 90 degrees. And so this goes into that because it's a superposition of up and to the right. And then here you just do that, and you also do it with a rotated Z, and you get this state.
Okay, but I mean, the control and the target are somewhat arbitrary.
Oh, no. Not in real vector space quantum mechanics. In complex vector space, it's true. They are arbitrary. So this controls that. You write it in a different basis, it looks like this controls that. But there's no such basis in the real space. You need complex numbers to do that.
Why?
Oh,
you have
wait, no, that's not true.
And then you have Hadamard,
so it's all... I know. No, you're right. You're right. I didn't say it the right way. No, it does not work. It does not work. Why does it not work? I've gone through this, and it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because it's not a controlled knot. It's a controlled rotation. That's different. There's a minus sign. Controlled knot is like a controlled flip. Okay, controlled knot is a controlled flip. This is a controlled rotation. That's the crucial difference. This thing, I didn't say it the right way. It's the fact that it's a controlled rotation, not a controlled flip. That's what makes that impossible.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can write it down.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Can you go back?
Yep.
So I'm not sure if this is a typo or I'm not understanding what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
The circle in the bottom right-hand corner.
Should I go like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I put a minus sign here, so that flips it up like that. It would have been pedagogically better to put a plus sign here and have it go down. I'm not sure why they did it.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah.
Would you think about every quantum system over the complex is carrying its own unit?
Isn't that a great question? That's a great question. And the answer is remarkably, that's what at first I was thinking. Okay, so every photon is going to be a protophoton with its own kind of mysterious other bit. But that's not what it is. You only need one. And one extra bit is good for the whole universe. Well, yeah, and actually that's exactly what this is, next slide is about. So the real representation of several photons of polarization, you have several photons, which in fact we do. Suppose they're all right circular, for example, in that state that I just described, which is this entangled state. The protophotons surely can't all be maximally entangled with the same rebit, can they? Because we have monogamy of entanglement, right? If two things are, if two things are entangled, that limits the entanglement that either of them can have with other things. That's true in the complex vector space, but it's not true in a real vector space. There's no monogamy of entanglement here. So an arbitrary number of these guys can be maximally entangled with the same rebit. This is something I was not aware of until I did this work. I'm sure other people
have,
but not me. Here's a paper where that fact is basically exploited in an analysis of quantum computation, that basically showing that you can do with rebits anything you can do with qubits computationally. You just need one extra rebit. Okay, so this is the picture that emerges then, that you have little proto objects which are in real vector spaces. And then, in addition, you have this one extra object, and it's only a rebit. It's just, but it's universal. It has to be able to interact with everything. So I'm imagining it being everywhere. And you may object. You may well object. Anyway, but imagine for now that it's everywhere. It can interact with everything. So that raises the following question. And actually, Eric Kamal-Kanti raised this question in an email. Said, well, look, if the motivation for the real vector space in the first place was something about observation, what can you observe, and these statistical fluctuations, and it all makes this nice sphere, then it kind of destroys the motivation if you then turn around and say, but you can't make certain measurements, okay? You can't really measure it. So, to take this motivation seriously, I really should say, in principle, we should be able to do all the things that you can do in a real vector space quantum mechanics. We shouldn't have to have a super selection rule. Shouldn't have to have any prohibition about measuring the u-bit. So the question is, is it conceivable that the super selection rule could emerge naturally, and we don't have to just impose it ad hoc, and that we can understand why we haven't been able to make these measurements, which in principle we could make. Okay, so now because the unit is everywhere, interacting with everything, then there would be decoherence all over the place, and would decoherence quickly bring all states and transformations to the standard form where they commute with this operator J? Okay, would decoherence enforce this commutation with J? And so the first thing I want to consider is this. Here's the little proto. This little rebit that I am particularly interested in, there's the u-bit, and here's the rest of the universe. Okay, so let's just suppose the u-bit is interacting with the rest of the universe, that's going to have some effect on z. It's going to have some effect on the state of az, and the fact that the state of az is what we're paying attention to. That's what we're looking at. So now, what follows is incomplete work. This is definitely work in progress. Well, the good news is I'm giving the talk today and not yesterday. I'll have more to say than I would have had yesterday. The bad news is that it's not tomorrow when I have more to say. But the good news is it's the afternoon and not the morning also. So what follows here are some numerical simulations done in the last few days with a randomly chosen Hamiltonian. A Hamiltonian, in this theory, is an anti-symmetric matrix, which when you exponentiate gives you an orthogonal matrix for the U-bit and the rest of the universe. Okay, so just randomly choose the Hamiltonian and see what happens. And the thing is, can you get the right kind of decoherence? Okay, so the good news is that if you have a large universe storing a random Hamiltonian for the U-bit and the rest of the universe, and let it run for a while, it does quickly make the state of AC, which is the state we care about, commute with J. Okay, it does do that. And so let me just, to quantify that, you take any density matrix of AZ, so it's a 4x4 real matrix.
We can
write it as a smutsy term. This part commutes with J, and we call that the good part of rho. This part anti-commutes with J, and we call it the bad part. And then the badness is going to be basically the size of the bad, a measure of the size of the bad part of rho. And how does the badness behave? And the good news is that the badness rapidly goes to a value that's small, and basically inversely to the dimension of the rest of the universe. That's what I've just been noticing numerically. I'm sure there's some easy way, and maybe one of you here will immediately see exactly why this is true, to see why this thing diminishes proportional to the dimension of the space of the rest of the universe. Now that's fine, because the rest of the universe does have a huge dimension, so we would not necessarily see this non-zero badness. Okay, the bad news is that the effect is too strong. If you just throw in a random Hamiltonian with the rest of it between the Z, the U-bit, and the rest of the universe, what happens is if you start with some generic state of AZ, it rapidly goes into a state that looks like this, where if you look at this, you'll see that the Z part, which is the smaller, it's the finer grained part of the matrix, is just the identity matrix. And this is a tensor product between some state of the U-bit A and then the identity matrix for the U-bit. Well, that's fine. Linear polarization was of that form. But what this is saying is that that's all you have. You don't have any other polarizations for a photon. You only have linear polarizations. So then the U-bit, is basically factoring out, it's completely irrelevant now, and it's not doing anything for us. Okay, we're getting back to the... Okay. This is what we wanted. We wanted to take the state not to that form, but to this form, where you have this little block here has these two equal and these two the negatives of each other. That's the desired form that commutes with J. And that would be fine. But that's not what you get. So that kind of decoherence doesn't work. So what do you try? Well, let's add one more component. Let's just make one more ad hoc assumption here, which is that the Z has its own Hamiltonian, which causes it to spin rapidly. Okay, it just goes around and around. Okay. So you add that to the Hamiltonian interacting Z with the universe,
and it actually works out
quite well.
If you
spin this thing fast enough, then if you start with this state, it does evolve pretty quickly into this form, the form that you want.
Aren't you basically twirling
it? That's what you're doing. You're twirling. This is exactly the
twirling it so quickly that it doesn't matter what's happening.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Right. You're twirling so quickly that it doesn't matter what else happens.
Okay.
But
why are you doing this?
Why?
Yeah. I mean, like,
what's the motivation?
Yeah.
The motivation is to get the right answer. Okay. But then it's also to think about it. So if we ever decide what the U-bit is, we also have to think, why is it spinning so fast? Okay. It must be spinning fast. But the nice thing is, this persists. Okay, once you get to this form, it doesn't decay to the bad form. It doesn't, the z doesn't factor out. It stays like that. Okay. But here's a worse challenge. Okay. That was pretty easy. There you had z interacting with the rest of the universe, but a was just sitting there, and it was we were not acting on it at all. Now let's try something else. Suppose we run a non-trivial Hamiltonian on A. So for a photon, suppose we're just trying to do something that would cause the Bloch sphere, or say for a spin, which is called sticking in a magnetic field. We want it to rotate for precess around some random axis. This is more dangerous for my program here, because so now you have this interaction here, but you also have A interacting with Z. So there's now the potential for information to leak out of A through Z to the rest of the universe. Remember, A is isolated. The way you look at it, there's A just sitting here, there's the rest of the universe. A is not doesn't seem to be interacting with anything. It's only interacting with this mysterious unit. But the unit is interacting with everything else. So there's the potential for information to leak out. And therefore, for the entropy of this thing to increase. And that sounds kind of bad and irreversible and not what we see in nature. In nature, you see something sitting still, it's isolated, it doesn't spontaneously increase its entropy. So the question is, I guess there are cases where, okay, anyway, does the state of AZ, so the question is, when you do this, does the state of AZ eventually commute with J? Okay, does it do that so that it's a good state, satisfying the superflexion rule? And also, even if it did that, it could be bad because it could collapse to a rebit. Okay, does it still act like a qubit, or does it Z factoring out leaving A as a simple rebit? So let me tell you some results. So here's what happens. I considered a couple of cases. First of all, suppose that the Hamiltonian between A and Z is a legitimate Hamiltonian, something that, like a rotation of the Bloch sphere, something that does commute with J. Then it's not great. It's not great. The results are not great. Information does leak out. It does leak out. And the purity, this is purity. I'm sorry, that's supposed to be good. This is the good part. The purity does get smaller, so that means the information is leaking out up to a certain point. Basically, what's happening, if you look at the results, the thing is sort of trying to rotate around the Bloch sphere, but there's this effect that's kind of squeezing it down into the real part of the Bloch sphere, like into the linear polarization. So that eventually happens. And there's a certain decay time where these are scale factors, the Hamiltonians of A and Z, and Z and the rest of the universe, and the
decay time scales
like this. So you'd have to have the omega, the omega is the spinning rate of the Z. It has to be sufficiently fast to overcome these guys. If it is sufficiently fast, then this could be a very long time before you see
the decay.
Okay?
Sorry? Can you put numbers on this?
Well, this is my best attempt to put numbers so far. I don't have that yet. But you can sort of imagine what's the total. Right. What's the total interaction energy between the U bit and the rest of the universe? Probably going to be huge.
Or just the frequency of the U bit itself.
Well, it just has to be much bigger than it just has to be much bigger than its interaction energy with the rest of the universe. So its own self-Hamiltonian has to be bigger than the Hamiltonian with its interaction Hamiltonian with the rest of the universe. Okay. So eventually Z does factor out, leaving A as just a simple rebit. Okay, and as I said, it affects a slow the projection down into the real part of the Bloch sphere. The other case, sorry? It's a spontaneous collapse to a piece of the block sphere. Right, yeah. Yeah, it's a funny kind of collapse. It basically, it's you know, it's the complex quantum mechanics collapsing down to real vector space quantum mechanics. That's what's happening. Now, a typical Hamiltonian between A and Z should not necessarily obey the superselection rule, not necessarily commute with J. So you try this, try a typical one, and you find, again, it decays as a galaxy. And I have not shown that here, but it just decays in that same way, but with a different time scale, typically. Still, if the spinning Z is fast enough, then you wouldn't see the decay for a long time. And in this case, it's very interesting that the qubit-like behavior, it doesn't collapse to just the real vector space part of the block sphere. The qubit-like behavior, some qubit-like behavior continues to happen even after the collapse. The collapse is about to here, but this is the entanglement between A and Z, which kind of oscillates when you're spinning around the block sphere in some non-real direction. You know, so here's the real plane of the block sphere. If you're doing this, that means the entanglement between A and Z is changing, is oscillating. And you still see that effect even after you're at the bottom of this galaxy. So that's sort of interesting. A tentative conclusion, though, but that's also not good, because you still have this increase of entropy for no good reason. So we might be able to recover an arbitrary good approximation to ordinary quantum mechanics if the U-bit is spinning sufficiently rapidly. But eventually, we're going to see this. You know, eventually, you'll see information leaking out. You'll see entropy increasing of a system that should just be sitting there, not interacting with anything. There's no reason for it to increase its entropy. Okay, let's see. How are we doing? So time-wise, I have 5 more minutes, I believe. So I wanted to say a few words about entropy. This is about entanglement. So this piece of the talk is not directly related to what we've just now talked about. It's about what does entanglement look like in this picture? Okay. What does entanglement look like? For a pure two-qubit state, here's a two-qubit state. You can always bring it to this form, where C0 and C1 are complex numbers. One measure of the entanglement between the two qubits is the tangle, which is just a simple function of those two numbers. It goes between 0 and 1. For a mixed state, we define the tangle of the mixed state to be the minimum average tangle of the pure states of the decomposition, minimized over all possible pure state decompositions of the density matrix. And that's all for ordinary qubits. For rebits, for real vector space case, use the same definitions. And then Chris Brooks and Caves and Runta have actually worked out a formula for what the tangle is for that case. It's very simple. You take your density matrix, you multiply it by sigma y times your sigma y. This is a real 4x4 density matrix. This is also a real 4x4 matrix. Take that trace, that's the tangle between two rebits. And it turns out that if you have two actual qubits, and you have the tangle between them, this is just a mathematical fact that you can relate that tangle, so that entanglement is just a simple combination of various rebit entanglements. So the golden things here are rebits, the purple things are qubits. So the entanglement between these two qubits is just the entanglement between the corresponding rebits, and modified by some various ways in which they're entangled with the universal bit. Okay.
Here we have
the universal bit entangled with these two, with the pair, universal bit entangled with just one of them, universal bit entangled with the other one. This is the kind of thing that in the complex case, this would always be a positive, or this would be a non-negative number. But in the real case, it can be negative. It can actually, the entanglement, Z bit can actually detract from the total entanglement. Here's some examples. Here's an actual entangled state of two qubits. It looks like an entangled state of two rebits, and the Z stuff doesn't do anything. here are two right circular photons. They're not entangled at all, but their rebits look like they're entangled, but then you have to subtract some stuff to see, because of the Z, to see that they actually have zero entanglement. Okay. So again, this is all just showing how different entanglement is for the for rebits. Okay, problems with this U-bit picture. You've probably already thought of 10 problems with the U-bit picture. I'm writing down two of them. One, arbitrariness of the real imaginary split. And here we have this photon polarization. I chose to represent linear polarizations as real combinations of two basis vectors, but one could choose other things. So there's some arbitrariness there. There's also the problem of instantaneousness if you've got this U-bit that's everywhere and interacting with everything. It would seem that one has to choose a special foliation of space-time, space-like surfaces, and you say, when you do something to the U-bit here, that happens everywhere on that whole surface. But maybe there's some more subtle way of interpreting this sharing of the U-bit. Maybe that's just too crude. Yes, Lee?
Is there a problem?
Sorry?
Is there a problem? I mean, there's lots of ways in which one tries to think beyond conventional quantum mechanics and the non-locality forces you to believe in.
Okay, so you're saying this is not a problem.
It's not manifested a problem.
Okay.
That's the only emergency.
Right. And one could choose some specific reference frame as natural, say the frame in which there's no, the cosmic background has no Doppler shift.
It's a turnaround, it's a possibility to disprove your theory by seeing two manifestly violation of Lorentz invariants, which is getting to be well tested.
Uh-huh. Right. Yes. Anyway, that's one of the features of this theory. You've got this thing that's everywhere. But I'll finish with some questions and conclusion. So it is true, we can obtain ordinary quantum mechanics from a real vector space theory. So if you like the real vector space theory, as I do, then we can just add a single universal rebit, and it's only one of them. That's all you need for the whole universe. But its state can't be accessed by direct measurement or coupling to other objects. That is, you can just say, by fiat, we insist that there's this rule, this super selection rule. That's one way to do it. I've explored a little bit in this talk another way of doing it, which is you don't do it by fiat, but you just say, under the right circumstances, we'd understand why we haven't been able to make certain measurements. It's because the thing is spinning very fast, faster than we can resolve. And that spinning manages to stave off the collapse to the real vector space theory for long enough that we have not seen it. This other side remark that ordinary two-qubit entanglement can be expressed as a rebit entanglement in a kind of remarkably simple way. Okay, here's some questions. So if the superselection rule is due to decoherence, how could we experimentally test for incomplete decoherence? How could we test this theory? So if the Z bit's not rotating infinitely fast, okay, some finite speed, then what's the easiest way that we could see that? What's the easiest way we could see this effect? I don't have an answer for that right now. Another question that may well have occurred to you is, what might the U bit be? Okay, what is it? Something that's binary, something that's fundamental and binary, and everywhere. Okay, what could it be? Well, what is it? What's something that's fundamental, that's and everywhere, and binary?
Direction of time.
Excellent. Who said that? Direction of time. This is exactly what I was thinking. Direction of time, or something like that. So you could say, everywhere there's the direction of time.
I was thinking is whether good will triumph over evil.
Right. Oh, I was thinking of the direction of time. So the deal is direction of time. And I like that idea. And then at first, it sounds kind of silly. Because what does it mean? It means, okay, so sometimes the direction of time is this way, and sometimes it's this way. Okay. And sometimes it's a superposition of those two, okay? And, you know, and this needs to change whenever you rotate a polarization, you know, when you send a polarized a photon through a quarter wave plate, then direction of time changes.
Wait a second.
Sorry.
You said you just need to twirl, right?
You just need to twirl.
So is twirling rebit equivalent to just completely decoherent?
In effect. Not completely decoherent. That's the thing. We don't want to completely decoherent. Completely decoherent collapses to the real vector space theory that we don't want, the small real vector space theory. We don't want a complete decohering. The twirling prevents that, actually. It prevents it, what would otherwise collapse. It sort of holds it off.
Okay, so it's not the same as just saying there's a direction of time, I just don't know which. It's not the same.
Right. But
is that the same as it's not the same.
Oh, not the same as direction of time. Rodney had another.
Is there also a theory that he wrote to any and it's representing direction of time? In which time is it rotating?
Yes. So we have here forward time, backward time, and it's rotating around. So that seems.
It sounds
very bad. I don't like this at all. So let's think about the following. One way. Oh, Lee has a mic. Okay. So one way to think about a rebit is as just one slice of the block sphere of a qubit. Okay. So suppose you have a qubit, which is the direction of time. Okay, where this is forward, this is backward, direction of time. That's a qubit. But now the rebit in question is just this equator, whatever that's called, of the block sphere, where there's an equal superposition of forward and backward. But the question is, what's the phase? Okay, the phase. That's all the rebit is. That's all the universal bit is. It's the phase between forward time and backward time, whatever that might mean.
Because then that's.
Yes, go ahead.
It's just that you said universal time, so does that imply that the time is switching from the universe?
Yeah, for the universe. That's right, for the whole universe. The phase.
But with each.
The phase can change.
Well, no. But what you said was.
What's that?
It's
entangled with everything, off with many things. Each of those particles' interaction with the qubit can change, cause the direction in the phase between forward and backward, whatever that phase means. Okay, yes, Lee, come in.
Is there any reason the qubits in the new space can't be higher dimensional and just rotating in two dimensions?
Oh, could it be higher dimensional?
I just have a dynamics where it's just oscillating in two dimensions.
It could certainly do that. I'd be happy with that. It could be a higher dimensional thing, and only two dimensions of it have the rotation. That would be fine. I just need the two dimensional spin. It's playing the role, as you can see. It's playing the role of the phase in quantum mechanics. That's kind of what it's doing. But except that it's being interpreted as a real thing. So, was there some other? Yes. Okay. Okay. So I have some really crazy ideas that are too crazy to be on PowerPoint. So I was thinking about drawing them over here. But maybe we'll save those for the question session because time's up for the talk. So thanks very much for listening. Rob.
So, I thought about similar sorts of things before, and I wonder how you feel about the current motivation of the superstructural.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking for a dynamical, coherent set of but other superstructural rules are often motivated another way. So you could say, there is a superstructural rule which ensures that all the quantum states are rotationally invariant in the universe. And the reason we have a superstructural rule is because it makes no sense to say whether a thing is pointing up in, you know, for the whole universe, because there's nothing outside the universe relative to which you could say it's up.
So there's no reference frame.
So there's no, you know, not the whole universe, you have no reference frames on the outside. Therefore, you should have states that are invariant under the period of system. Mm-hmm. So the analogous thing here is to say, what direction of time is the universe progressing in? Mm-hmm. You say, well, that doesn't make sense unless you have a reference frame. And therefore, the entire universe has to be invariant under reversals in time. Mm-hmm. And the consequence is that the density operator for the universe should be an equal mixture of rho and complex conjugate of rho, which is the time reverse version.
Which is J rho J.
Right.
So you have rho combined with J rho J.
And so you get a real quantum mechanics for the whole universe by virtue of a symmetry principle, namely that the state of the universe should be invariant under time reversal. And then you're done. So you don't have to deal with the dynamical of the coherence. You just are motivated. And all you have to assume is that there's one extra funny thing on that.
Yeah, which is the direction of time, but we have no way of measuring it. Right. That's what you said.
It's a bit such that within the universe, you could say that's my reference frame for time.
Uh-huh.
Talk about whether I'm propagating forward or backward.
Right.
If there's nothing outside of the universe.
That could define the direction. That sounds a lot easier than what I was hearing, doesn't it? Because you don't have the dynamic. You don't have to worry about the difference.
The real world starts with that thing, also part of that function.
You wouldn't get complex quantum mechanics just by saying the quantum state of the universe ought to be invariant from time reversal. Really, you'd have to say, suppose that in addition to all the systems that we normally describe, we had one extra system. We look at the quantum state of that. And then we could imagine that if the invariant is under time reversal, then you could have.
Mm-hmm. You get exactly the quantum mechanics that you want.
Yeah.
That's it. It gives you exactly the effect of the superposition. Yes, and then and
so if so, I was thinking something similar based on what you said with the rebit as the equatorial plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you have that, you just spin it. And correct me if I'm wrong, but don't you just get a mixture of 1 and 0?
If that's all you have, that's what you would get. But what you start with is this very highly entangled state between this thing and all the other parts of the world, all of the pieces of the universe. So then the rotation gives you something non-trivial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was trying to figure out how to combine what Rob's saying with this idea that the rebit might refer somehow to, I don't know, time, very skeptical about this, but if it did, then I would want something in order to just address the seventh objection, that you know, you could have, like, what part of time is. I mean, would time be moving in different regions of space? That just seems a little bit funny.
Well,
but if you have this idea that you just don't know, I mean, that there is no reference frame for an objective direction.
Yeah, I mean, it is only one bit. I mean, it's not varying from here to here. So it doesn't have position dependence.
Right, exactly.
Lee.
So, two things. I don't understand why, if I can't just continue to work in the system, I don't understand why I can't be the overall direction of space rather than of time.
Oh.
I have a system, the nature of the system of spins, and now I make a statement that dynamics is really engagement. So now I make a statement that dynamics is invariant under rotations. There's no particular direction.
Uh-huh.
And I somehow that's equivalent to somewhere in the world there's a spin.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't matter what direction it's pointing.
Somewhere in the world there's a spin. Right.
That's not what, and it happens to be universally coupled.
Exactly.
And which we can arrange.
We can arrange. Okay. Well, that's certainly the spirit in which I was doing these dynamical things, right? That there was an actual bit with somewhere.
Now, does the coupling of this spin, so now it's the arrangement, does the coupling of the spin to every effective quantum degree of freedom have to be with the same strength?
Oh, not at all. That's a great question. No, not at all. Because, I mean, for example, sometimes it won't be coupled at all. I mean, you may have some spin one half particle just sitting here, not changing. It doesn't need to have any Hamiltonian with the U bit.
So something's in that.
but that's another thing that's actually, say, spinning very fast. It has to have a strong coupling with the U-bit in order to spin fast. The coupling with the U-bit is part of that motion.
Right, so supposing the world is something like a lattice, like the lattice is like a small world network.
Uh-huh.
As on top of some regular local structure, there's some long distance connections.
Uh-huh.
And supposing these things tend to be heterogeneous, and supposing that somewhere there's one spin which has a connection, you know, which comes, you know, close enough to almost everything.
Oh, I see, because of the small world. So that you mean there's some indirect coupling?
Well, you know, say you know, comes within the kind of wavelength of an electron.
All right. Okay. That sounds good.
I mean, you don't have to put many random long-range links on a network to get a situation where you can get from any point to any other point.
Uh-huh. Right, I see. So what I was describing, though, is a single link between Z and, say, particle C. In that picture, would actually be a little bit indirect, but not very long. But wouldn't have to be very long. Right.
Sorry, is this rebit just the overall phase?
It's playing the role of the overall phase. Right. It's playing a role. Except that it's not that, because we can get entangled with it. See, we never talk about being entangled with the overall phase.
You talk about relative phases in interstates.
I mean, it's the overall phase in the following sense, that if you rotate the Z, okay, the U bit, it doesn't change anything. If you just do a rotation of the U bit, that doesn't change the physical state at all. It literally does not change it. The density matrix stays exactly the same of every single subsystem of the universe.
Right.
So it's like the overall phase in that respect. But it's not like the overall phase in that we're treating it as an object that things can be entangled with.
Well, this is the problem. I mean, okay, so it's conflating two different roles then, because it's playing a role of relative phase.
Yes, it is.
And it's also playing a role of overall phase.
Yes, it is. That's right.
But we never worry about twirling the overall phase.
Right.
We just get rid of it.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Is there a way that we could just trace it out?
Well, I think that's sort of what Rob's suggestion would be. Say we get rid of it because we have no way of measuring. We have no reference frame which is measuring.
Well, how would you just trace it out? You just ignore it. Is that the same thing?
Oh, no. If you trace it out, you lose everything. If you trace it out, you lose the entanglement, and then you're.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying you forget about it, and then you evolve things. I'm saying whenever you want to look at the universe, you just ignore that part of it, just pretend it's over there, and then you just let it do its thing.
Somehow, it's not quite like that, because if that were the case, if you could just ignore it, then everything would just collapse down into the little real vector space theory with n dimensions.
But hang on. The probabilities that we get depend only on the rebit values, correct? Or do they depend on the u-bit as well?
Oh, no, it depends on the u-bit. It depends on how it's correlated, how it's entangled with the u-bit. Yeah.
Because we want to follow up questions, here's a wild question.
Yes.
Just speaking about this analogy of time and things like this, mm-hmm. You know, we know from quantum field theory that if we have time, we multiply by I or minus I, basically being rotated, we get inverse temperature.
Right.
So what about this? Have you thought about this?
I had not thought about that at all.
If you're talking about rotating,
Yeah, I think any extemporaneous answer I give that would be completely stupid. So I'm just going to shut up about that. I'll have to think about that.
Another suggestion of what this alleged universe phase would be, if it's spinning, you don't know how to do a measure of how it's spinning, that's a measure of time. The universal second is the.
So this sets the scale for time.
Yeah, this is the scale of time. And you can't get rid of it because you have to have the phases of different times compared then. So it's universal.
Uh-huh. And now we can explain gravity if we can find some reason why it slows down sometimes. Near a massive object, this thing slows down, suppose.
This is kind of universal.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It can't do that. I'm sorry. Yeah, it doesn't depend on space. Yes.
What happens with continuous variables?
Oh, yeah, it's a great question. This is all done with discrete Hilbert space. But of course you can do this. You should be able to do this with ordinary wave functions.
Why?
Why should you be able to do that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't see any reason why not. I mean, what you could do is you say, take the absolute value of a wave function. That's a real function. It's really just square roots of probability densities. And then you also have this phase, okay, as many people have done, all right? I mean, you've seen that in Ariel's talk, and Michael's talk.
What was the reason for that?
Well, I think it's a phase function rather than a phase in the CV system, right? Is that what it would be?
Right. So square root of p times e to the is sort of thing that we've seen before. Where the e to the is, that would be the u-bit. So the u-bit would have to play that role. Well, so you'd have some kind of fancy entanglement between this continuous variable object and single bit. Okay, the u-bit is still a bit. It doesn't have to be any bigger than it was.
Well, maybe. I mean, if you can simulate CVs with qubits, then you can simulate CVs with 3 bits plus 1 u-bit.
Yes, Aaron.
I don't know what the motivation for this would be, but could you make a hybrid system that's part complex, part of it?
Sure.
I'm not sure. You may run into some contradictions somewhere. Yeah. I don't know about that.
You have standard complex quantum mechanics just to read the quantum.
Yeah, that's right. We have it.
So it should be fine. You just take part of it and read the other stuff.
And in a way, this dynamical picture gives you something like that. Because on the way towards decay to the real state, you're in this regime where it's partly complex and partly real. Starts out looking like complex quantum mechanics, eventually decays to real quantum mechanics. So in between, you have some other theory.
So one reason, I mean, one unit is with no need for one unit.
That is correct.
What do you want to have more? Because it's kind of weird to just have one of those. So could you have as many as you want? Does it go wrong if you have too many branches? Because you could also stick, like, you could then have time going fast and slow, and both of you can get branches.
It's a good question, and I haven't actually thought about that.
You may be inconsistent if you want to write on branches.
My guess is that it's not going to give us regular quantum mechanics. I'm just guessing that composite systems won't act the right way if they have different little auxiliary bits.
Okay. Hadn't you said you tried that?
Had I said I tried that?
I thought you had said that you had tried that when you were first thinking about this.
What I said was, not so much tried, it's just that's what I expected. But then realized that no, it's not the way it is. But so I didn't actually follow that route.
Aren't they going to be entangled all along themselves?
Hmm?
Aren't they going to be entangled all along themselves?
They could be entangled with each other.
With each other, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're supposed to have to be increased, certainly, the dynamic.
Mm-hmm. But you can just pretend they're just not a bit.
They're all entangled, just not a bit.
Yeah.
Like they're just dicks.
Actually, it's interesting to explore that. It would not be too hard to work something out and see if that's going to work.
If you can encode a read in a bunch of readers, then you just project down to the single read it takes from a bunch of read it cases, and then you just have a bigger superflexion. But it still works. Your superflexion rule says we want a read it, but we only want the twirled subspace of that rebit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a bunch of rebits, mm-hmm. and you can encode one rebit within it,
Oh, yeah.
The unit is distributed overall, and then you just have a bigger super-selection mode that just says you project on a single read it, you project it on the twirl.
But then I think everything is interacting with the whole thing, right? That is, once again, it's not that this one has its own private. It's not that each little proto qubit has its own private. Chris?
Oh, I was wondering what the really
I want to
see what the really crazy
stuff. Oh, the really crazy stuff. Yeah, sure.
Let's move this along.
Okay. So unlike Lee, I was a little bit worried about this foliation and so, you know, having to say what means the same time in all these different places. So I was wondering about, but this is going to be worse maybe. So here's your particle that you're interested in. And here is its future light cone, here's its past light cone. Okay, and so now you have a whole bunch of other particles in the universe which are sort of traveling through there. It's an expanding universe, so that's why they do this. And so I think of each of these particles moving through as carrying its own little phase that goes around and around and around each of the I mass times the mass of the thing. So the mass of each particle gives it a little phase that goes around. Okay. And so therefore you have some phase factor here and then a different phase factor here because these things have twirled around because of their mass, their phase. And so you have some overall some net phase of at the future light cone and some net phase at the past light cone. And they're going to be different, and the difference between those phases is the value, is the state of the u-bit. Okay, it's just a phase, so it's just going around. And that's the phase that it is. So if you do time reversal, it conjugates that. So because the universe is expanding, here you have a redshift in the phase. Okay, these guys are going away. So there's a redshift in the phase as seen from here. These guys are not going so, because they're going away. Here there's a blue shift because it's the future light cone. So they're still going away, but it's just that the light comes from the other way, so there's a blue shift. So the fact that there's this red shift here and there's this blue shift here means that the relative phase between here and here, as seen from here, is indeed rapidly going around and around and around because the universe is expanding.
So
okay, that was too crazy. That's exactly. I'm looking for a mechanism for the rotation. So the expansion of the universe explains the rotation. But there are about a dozen questions that I could immediately ask myself about this. So
I really thought you were going to connect this. You wrote a paper once titled "Why Do Things Fall?"
Oh yeah, right.
Do you have a connection between this?
Oh, that's nothing controversial there. Yeah. No particular. That's just things fall because time goes, because clocks run slower near a massive object.
Are you implying that your qubit is a candidate dark energy?
Sorry?
Are you implying that your qubit is a candidate?
Oh yeah, we mentioned dark energy the other day. So this doesn't have to do with that, but we understand why the universe has to be expanding so the qubit can spin. Okay, that's probably enough for that. It's one of those things that sits in the head and you have to get it out. Rob?
Yes. I think I have a remark, I don't know if I got it right, where you said that the systems sometimes couple to the qubit and sometimes they don't.
It's true.
It changes.
It's true.
Depending on the state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so how it's evolving.
And if you prepare a very special initial state in which none of the systems is coupling to the qubit.
To the qubit, right.
Mm-hmm. To the qubit.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get the whole process going? Mm-hmm. Nothing from that particular initial state.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd have to do something that couples them. Evidently, we know how to do this because we can build a quarter wave plate, for example. So if all we had were things that rotated polarization of photons, thinking of photon polarization, if that's all we had, that would mean we just haven't learned how to couple to the U-bit. But somehow we've learned to couple to the U-bit because we can build a quarter wave plate, okay, which doesn't just rotate polarization, but it can turn linear into circular. And so somehow that physical object provides the coupling. If we never figured out how to do that, we would be living in real vector space quantum again. Quite a different world.
I just think sort of systems sometimes couple and then they don't couple, and the strength of the coupling varies depending on their state.
Exactly, and you have some control over it. You put this device here, you take it away, so you get to control. So it's not as if the U-bit is completely outside of our control. We have these ways of controlling the coupling. We can have ways of affecting the U-bit. We can affect the U-bit. Anyone in the universe can rotate the U-bit, perfectly allowed. We just can't extract information. And that's actually another way to motivate the superselection rule. You could say, if you didn't have the superselection rule, then and if it weren't imposed dynamically, then you could communicate instantaneously from one place to another by putting information in the U-bit and having someone else get it out. Because the superselection rule is what prevents you from extracting information from the U-bit. Okay, so without the so that's another way of motivating the superselection rule. So you have to have that rule if the U-bit is everywhere. Otherwise, we could it would be a signaling theory. We could have instantaneous signaling over arbitrary distance. So if we want to impose non-signaling, you get your superselection.
Selection idea on real-world space as fundamental, then any sorts of interpretations that will work with it are interpretations that are about the real-world space as well as object called.
Yes.
And I was thinking probably the evolving bones would have a severe problem if we restricted the evolving bone with the idea that it's just a real wave function always, then there's never any momentum, if you like, and there's never any evolution, and there's no proper uncertainty relations, there's no, I'm thinking even more generally for the continuous case, you wouldn't be able to define the mission very easily, or a classical limit. The U-bit would somehow have to be responsible for the classical limit.
It would.
Even in a continuous case.
It would. The U-bit would be what you need in order to have momentum, for example. Right.
I'm missing something. This real theory reproduces complex quantum mechanics. So anything you do with complex, you can do with this. So what are you saying?
I'm saying this theory relies on nature being described by a real world space. Some interpretations of quantum mechanics, complex quantum mechanics, don't have interpretations that I could say, or think that would be rather silly. If you try to apply them to a real-world space, particularly in continuous space.
But this this is equivalent to a complex space. So it's all from.
It doesn't matter that it's equivalent to it, it's really real one. Fundamentally, if you take this fundamentally, it's a real-world space.
Though there may be some way of.
The answer is you. Where's the you because it involves your own interpretation? That's probably a real problem.
Okay, so I guess it is an open problem to see how the road bone.
And what would it look like? What would the words? What would the words look like? What would you have to say? Yeah.
Alright.
Now,
You mentioned at the beginning that if you make quantum mechanics with real little space, then you lose a local discriminability. Right. Now there is universal bit. How did does what is the mechanism that by which this U-bit solves the problem of local stimulation of
Yes. Yes. It solves it only if we believe that we can measure the unit. So it solves it only if we can, if we believe that. So we have to say, in principle, we can measure the u-bit, okay? But we haven't been able to do it in practice because it's spinning faster than our time resolution, than the best time resolution that we can do. You know, so if we just improved our instruments, then we could make these measurements, we could make these discriminations, and then we would have this local discrimination, so that any two states that are a little bit different, you know, would give you different probabilities of the outcomes of some measurement. It's just a measurement that we haven't figured out how to do, because we can't resolve the spinning. I think I'd have to say that.
Imaginary, and then you take the 2x2 identity tensor real part of A plus the 2x2 symbolic tensor tensor the imaginary part of A, and that thing is real, means that the symbolic matrix, because the symbolic matrix decomposes as 2x2 symbolic tensor identity.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed.
So it's going to work for the continuous variables and
yes, indeed. That's right. That's right. So, I mean, but basically, yeah, so I think it's equivalent to the little formula I was saying, where you replace every A plus IB with a little 2x2 matrix. But what you just argued is more general. Yeah, good.
I'm going to get that question. And A recollection from Stubelberg, which may be mistaken, that there's another constraint imposed, which will take you from complex to turning on.
Oh, yeah.
Complex can be embedded in real by virtue of a.
Oh, yes.
Turning on it can be embedded within complex.
Indeed. He addresses this in an appendix in that article, which it's been years since I've read, so I can't actually remember the details of that. It's a great question, though. But yeah. You're right.
What's the physical significance of that fact? If you
did
this further,
embedded, just playing through a box. It hasn't, but it's a great question. What's the physical significance of that? I don't know immediately. I mean, all I can say is, so if we ever discover evidence that nature really is quaternionic, that I can still maintain that it's real at base and it's got these super selections. Yeah.